Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts is getting in on the fight, challenging the Trump administration over including a citizenship question in the 2020 census.
By inserting this question, it's clearly an effort to confuse and discourage response on the part of immigrants.
Also, Congressman Jim McGovern joins us to talk about the census and other happenings in D.C. Plus, it's tax season, and it may have gotten easier to dodge the tax man.
As former IRS Commissioner Larry Gibbs once said, there are three types of taxpayers: those who comply, those who are trying to comply, and those who are actively trying not to comply.
Plus, a new study says it's true. Boston area drivers are spending more time commuting than they did just 5 years ago.
My general commute is 8 miles, and in the morning it takes me, on average, about 30 minutes to get there.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts plans to join California in suing the federal government over changing the 2020 census. The Commerce Department announced yesterday that at the request of the Justice Department, it will include a question about citizenship status on the census. California is suing, saying that that question violates the Constitution and would suppress participation in the census. And here in Massachusetts, Secretary of State Bill Galvin says he's working with State Attorney General Maura Healey and reviewing legal options. Well, Secretary Galvin is on the line to talk about this. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Happy to be with you, Deborah.
So you're the state's 2020 census liaison. Correct. With the federal government. So
yes.
Why are you taking issue with this question of citizenship?
Because it's totally inappropriate and clearly an effort at sabotaging the census in states like Massachusetts. The federal code, the federal law, is we count everybody. We count every person, irrespective of their legal status, of their citizenship status. To insert this question is clearly an effort to minimally confuse the respondents, if not to deter them. The reason I say deter them is because clearly we've all seen the not only the rhetoric on immigration, but also the actions that have been so hostile to immigrants. But even if you're a legally present immigrant, you needlessly might be confused by this question. It does not belong in the census. If you're looking for an accurate, neutral count, which is what the census ought to be, it ought to be a non-political, accurate count. You count everybody. Now, we've always had a challenge here in Massachusetts. I have been the census liaison for the last two census efforts in 2010 and 2000. And the diversity of our immigrant population here in Massachusetts, speaking multiple languages, coming really from throughout the whole world, has always been challenging. And even legally present immigrants would question, why would they respond to this? Now, to insert this into the questionnaire is clearly an effort to deter and confuse. The result is going to be that it's going to result in a much more difficult count and possibly an impossible count. I use the Donahue Institute at UMass Boston as our statistical liaison on this issue. They speculate we have an actual population of about 6.8 million. I shouldn't say speculate. That's their assessment. Mm-hmm. To get to that number, we obviously have to count all of our immigrants, all the persons who are present here. We also, by the way, have to count college students, which the Trump administration separately is doing something to deter that as well. This is going to adversely affect our count. And what that means in the big picture is it's going to run the risk of a loss of congressional representation and therefore an electoral vote. It also is going to cost money. And it's particularly going to cost money in the cities and towns that need it the most, those that have the highest immigrant populations, where the needs for public education, public health, public transportation are greatest. This is an effort at sabotaging the census, and I think it's a political motivation. This is not about an accurate count.
So folks know that the Justice Department has said that this citizenship data will help identify any Voting Rights Act violations and make sure that there's an accurate count of the citizen voting age population. What do you say to that argument? Well, and also the Commerce Secretary says no evidence to suggest that asking this question on the census would decrease participation in the census.
Let me start with the second point first.
Okay.
The evidence from those of us who've actually taken the census before is ample. You always have issues persuading legally present immigrants to participate. Anyone who has heard the rhetoric coming out of this administration or seen the arrests of people who are non-citizens, who are immigrants illegally here or undocumented or whatever category you want to classify them in, would know, and anyone who's talked to immigrants would know, that they're already on edge. To try to ask them to participate and then confuse them by throwing this question is so obviously an effort at discouraging them. It's beyond responding to. The first point is that the Justice Department generally has had no problem in most administrations in enforcing the voting rights law. They don't need this question to do it. In fact, there's been very little evidence that this particular Justice Department is interested in enforcing the voting rights law. On the contrary, they seem completely disinterested in it. So that's specious at best. It's inaccurate. If they have issues on voting, you would already be dealing with citizens. You don't need to know whether these people are citizens or not. And it has nothing to do with an actual count. It has nothing to do with the count. What it is going to do is it's going to discourage the count. It's going to make the count more difficult. And that is really what they're up to. This is nothing less than an effort to sabotage the census, particularly in states with high immigrant populations, with populations that could be in congressional districts that would likely elect Democrats and have electoral votes that would likely vote for Democratic candidates. It's not an accident that Massachusetts, California, and New York are the ones that are going to be most adversely affected. So
what's next for the Commonwealth? What are you looking at legally?
The Attorney General has already had previously written to Secretary Ross. She is in contact with some of the other attorneys general. There's going to have to be, like everything else with this administration, you can't negotiate because they don't want to listen. It has to be a litigation. That's the only thing they're going to understand. It's clearly going to run the risk of undoing a legal comprehensive census. And it's contrary to federal code. That's the most important thing. The federal code says you count everybody. It doesn't say citizens. It has nothing to do with citizenship. It's everybody. That's what the federal law is. So clearly, if you're putting questions in there that are not related to that federal obligation, you're doing something that is not appropriate. And that's the essence of the litigation. I'm confident she will participate and she will get us the best result we can. But I think this has to be called out for what it is. And it's an effort to politicize and sabotage the census.
Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
To talk more about this change in the census and other topics in Washington, we're joined by Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern. He's with us as part of our series of in-studio conversations with members of the state's congressional delegation. Congressman, thanks so much for coming in.
Happy to be here.
So you just heard from Secretary of State Galvin regarding this change in the census from the Justice Department and the Commerce Department. What do you think about it?
Well, I'm glad Massachusetts is joining with other states in filing suit, and I think we will win. I think the administration clearly is trying to undercut the census so that we don't get an accurate count. And, you know, if they succeed, that's bad news for Massachusetts. It's bad news for a lot of states in this country because the census, is used in formulas to determine federal aid to communities. I mean, whether it's health care, whether it's infrastructure aid, whether it's money for law enforcement or education. I mean, it is the census count that determines where the funds go. And so if you don't get an accurate count, you're going to lose out on important federal monies that we rely on.
We lost a seat
in the last
census.
That. You can always lose a congressional seat, too. Yeah, we did lose a seat, too. So this is a serious matter, and I think the administration, never misses an opportunity to try to demonize immigrants or bash immigrants, and this is just the latest in a long series of things that they've done to go after immigrants.
So you would agree with Secretary Galvin?
I do. I agree with
you.
You
don't think it's about getting an accurate count of the voting?
Oh, I don't think it's about. You know, if the administration was concerned about an accurate count, you would think that they would engage the governors and secretaries of state and attorney generals in states all across the country. There's no consultation. You know, this is a soundbite. It's red meat for their base. And again, it's a continuation of their anti-immigrant rhetoric.
For this change to go through, is there anything Congress can do? Or can the Department of Justice just issue this?
Well, I think Congress can probably do something. The question whether Congress will. Mm-hmm. We have a Congress that has been complicit in almost everything that this administration has done that I think most people think, are bad ideas. And I don't expect Speaker of the House Paul Ryan or the Majority Leader in the Senate Mitch McConnell to all of a sudden develop a spine and do the right thing when it comes to this issue.
So let's change topics here. We've, of course, in the news all day today, actually for the past couple of days, it's the Russian story, Russian diplomat story. The White House is expelling 60 Russian diplomats, saying they were intelligence agents, and that's in retaliation for a former Russian spy and his daughter who were poisoned by an apparent Russian nerve agent when they were in the UK. What's your view on this? Was this a strong enough move by the White House?
I don't disagree with expelling Russian diplomats, but the Russians are going to expel U.S. diplomats. And so, I mean, everything will kind of even out. I mean, I think Russia needs to pay a consequence for what they did, but not only poisoning a former Russian agent, but, I mean, they're meddling in our election and so many other things that they've been guilty of. So, I mean, I would have been for imposing tighter sanctions. But I think Russia needs to understand that when they do these things, when they meddle in our election, when they murder people in places that are not Russian soil, that there has to be a consequence. I'm not sure that what we did is strong enough.
You think it should? What would have made it stronger?
I would have liked to have seen more sanctions at a minimum. Mm. And I would like to see the President of the United States at long last actually say something bad about Putin. I mean, not congratulate him on a fraudulent election, be quiet in the face of one atrocity after another, not try to deny that they meddled in our election. I mean, it would be nice if the leader of the United States of America would get up and say, this is something that we can't stand for, we will not tolerate.
Hmm. What about what's happening with China and the tariffs in China? How do you think that that's going to affect the economy right now? And is that a strong move on the part of the
world? Yeah, so look, I mean, I will agree with the president China has taken advantage of us and a lot of our trading practices.
We're going to have to quote you there. You would agree with the
president.
Well,
this is probably, yeah. I mean, I know it's a, but having said all that, I think we need to acknowledge that and we need to address it. How do you address it, is where I disagree with the president. I'm not sure that kind of on a whim announcing to the world that we're going to impose tariffs and then when asked how much, coming up with a number out of thin air about how much they would be, is the way you do constructive engagement and the way you get China to change its ways in a way that doesn't result in a trade war. I mean, we don't want a trade war. We want is fair trade. And I think that there's, I'm not quite sure where this administration is going with all of this because I haven't heard them articulate a policy that gets us to where we want to get to, and that is where we're competing on a more level playing field.
So what steps would be good? One step.
Well, first
maybe.
Of all, I mean, if I were the president of the United States, I would be sitting down with the Chinese leader and having a very frank conversation about the imbalance in our trade practices with China, and I would be setting forward a series of steps with maybe tariffs as the ultimate step if in fact we weren't getting any cooperation. But I think one of the things about this White House is that, one day the president's talking tough on trade. The next day he has a whole different opinion. Mm. One day he says he wants to help the Dreamers, and then the next day he doesn't. One day he says he's for gun control, and then the next day he's, having dinner with the head of the NRA. So I have no idea what this administration believes, and I think, I think most of the world shares my opinion of him.
Hmm. Let's talk about guns and the March for Our Lives just this past weekend around the country here in Boston and also in Washington, D.C., where I believe you were at the march with your daughter.
It was with my 16-year-old daughter, Molly, and I were at the march in Washington.
Why'd you go with your daughter?
Well, she wanted to go, and she asked me to go with her. I mean, I always hoped I was going to go anyway, but it's nice when, my daughter, suggested and asked me to go with her. Look, I thought it was important to be there, and I have such great admiration for these young people who are, who organized this march and who are speaking truth to power. When I was in high school, I don't know if I would have had the courage to be able to debate my senator or my member of Congress on this issue. And yet, that's happening all over the country. And, you know, these young people, and my daughter included, don't want a future where they have to be afraid to go to school or go to a movie or go to a concert or go to a nightclub or even go to church. And they're frustrated by the fact that there is nothing coming out of Washington to address any of their concerns. You know, I mean, this is not a new issue. I mean, we've been having massacres for a long time. Gun violence in this country, you know, is higher than almost any other country in the world. And yet we have done nothing other than have moments of silence in the aftermath of tragedies.
So have these students done anything? You know, we spoke with you prior to the earlier school walkout, and you had said that you hoped that these students, their passion would put pressure on Congress and lead to Congress doing this. Do you think that these marches and what we saw over the weekend are going to result in any action?
I do. I really do. I believe it. I believe that the pressure is real. I mean, I've talked to some of my colleagues, who were happy to get out of town before Saturday because they didn't want to be around when these young people came to town. But I'll tell you, I talked to dozens and dozens and dozens, well, maybe hundreds of people that day, including a lot of students that came down from, you know, my congressional districts. We had a group of high school students from Sutton and from Amherst that were down there marching as well. But these students aren't going to give up. And their message is very clear to their elected officials. You're either with us or you're against us. And if you're against us, we're against you. And we're going to unelect you. And you can't hide behind the Republican leadership, which is preventing any kind of gun control legislation from coming to the floor. I mean, that's the frustration that a lot of people have is, look, bring these bills to the floor, debate them, vote on them. If you want to vote no, vote no. But, you know, the greatest deliberative body in the world ought to be able to deliberate. And the Republican leadership ought to not be protecting its members from these difficult votes. I think you're going to see people lose their elections over this issue.
Really? Yeah. Well, that'll be. Are you concerned at all about the backlash against some of these young people? There's been some pretty strong backlash. And I wonder if that's, concerning to you.
It is. I mean, I've seen some of the things that have been posted about these young people, and I've seen the NRA's response to these young people, which is, quite frankly, disgusting. But I got to tell you, those students from Parkland, Florida, saw their friends gunned down right before their very eyes. They're horrified by that. And they're never going to forget it. And they're never going to forget those politicians who didn't have the guts to stand up to the NRA. So, you know, these young people, they're tough and they're determined. They don't want their friends' deaths to be in vain. I mean, they want their lives to mean something. And they're not going to give up. And their passion, I mean, is caught on all across the country. I mean, high schools, students everywhere are taking to the streets, are lobbying their members of Congress. So I am hopeful that this is going to result in something positive. It may not be everything we want at once, but I think there'll be. I think they will get something.
We'll get a ban on assault weapons?
Well,
that's what we ought to
strive toward. But here's the deal. Can we at least get in place universal background checks so that anyone who buys a gun has to go through a background check? I mean, that might be a good start. We can't even get that bill to the floor for a debate or a vote. I mean, you know, if you're on an FBI terrorist watch list, you can't fly on a commercial airplane. I mean, I'm glad I fly every week back and forth to Washington. But yet you can legally go out and buy an assault weapon. Mm-hmm. And this notion that people ought to be able to buy whatever kind of gun they want is just silly and stupid and dangerous. I mean, why do people need to purchase weapons that are designed for only one thing, and that is to kill another human being? There has to be some common sense here, and these young students are are relentless, and I have great confidence that they're going to make a difference.
I wonder, something that's come up is a ban on manufacturing the type of gun that was used in Parkland, which is made at Smith & Wesson in Springfield, not in your district, but close. A lot of jobs in Massachusetts. The Washington Post did an excellent article about the division in the community. Some people say it's a big employer here, and why should they be penalized? I mean, what should we ban the manufacture of these types?
Well, the deal is, you know, we can't even get Congress to consider a bill that requires universal background checks. I mean, I think manufacturers have some responsibility here. But what did Congress do? They provided immunity to all gun manufacturers so that nobody can sue them if they behave in a careless way. We had a gun manufacturer in Worcester that didn't do background checks on their security guards and had a robbery where guns were stolen and nobody reported it, and one of those guns was used in the killing of a young person in our city. And clearly this gun manufacturer was negligent, and the NRA sensed that, and they pushed Congress to act on a bill to provide immunity to every gun manufacturer in the country. Look, the way things are going to change is when politicians of both parties have the guts to stand up to the NRA and they stop taking the NRA's blood money, because that's what it is. And I go back to my conversation with my daughter during this march in Washington. She can't understand, you know, what's so difficult about doing the right thing here. She doesn't get it. And I'm with her. I mean, there's no explanation other than the fact that you get members of Congress who are too afraid of the NRA to do the right thing. And I'll tell you something, I get it, you know, people are afraid of losing their election, but try losing a child. And that's unfortunately, the choice that people are going to have to grapple with.
So would you support a ban on manufacturing these types of, like an AK-15 or something?
I mean, I personally would, but that's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that I would propose that
AR-15.
AR-15, right? That don't have a chance of going anywhere in Congress. But here's the deal. I mean, let us begin with the notion that Congress ought to debate these issues and they ought to vote on these issues. To my friends who are, taking the NRA position of, you know, we're not going to do anything, I would just simply say make your case on the House floor or on the Senate floor and vote your conscience. But, you know, for the sake of the people of this country, and given what's going on and the level of gun violence in this country, we ought to have that debate. I don't know what the hell is so wrong with having a debate on guns, given the amount of the high numbers of people who are dying each and every day as a result of gun violence.
Just because we have very limited time left, you're on the House Committee on Agriculture and a big piece of legislation that's set to expire this September, the Farm Bill. I'm just wondering, what, because of what you're talking about right now and what's happening in Congress, what's the main concern you have for that legislation to go forward?
Well, one is we haven't seen any of the text of the legislation. I mean, I'd like to see the bill before we vote on it. Mm-hmm. And two, what we're hearing is that the Republican leadership has targeted the nutrition title. That's the title that includes programs like SNAP, which used to be known as food stamps. And, you know, I'm the ranking Democrat in the Nutrition Subcommittee. I believe that we ought to end hunger in this country, not make it worse. You know, I said at the beginning of this debate that I will not support a farm bill that makes hunger worse. What we're hearing that the Republicans are planning to do would throw millions and millions of people off of this benefit. And I find that unconscionable. They view SNAP as an ATM machine to pay for their tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires. I view SNAP as a lifeline for millions of families in this country. Food ought to be a right for every single person in this country. I believe it ought to be a right for every single person on this planet. But I'm sick and tired of this discussion that of farm bills that basically, treat poor people in such a shabby way. We're better than this. And so, I've said from the beginning, no farm bill is better than a lousy farm bill. And what we're hearing about this farm bill is that it's lousy, it's cruel, it's rotten, it ought to be defeated.
Hmm. All right. Congressman Jim McGovern, I'm sure we'll be talking with you about that when it comes up. Thanks so much for coming in studio today. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the weather and the traffic are probably two things almost all New Englanders find themselves complaining about. And a new analysis says when it comes to traffic, you may be completely justified because, yes, commute times in Greater Boston really are getting worse. Boston Globe reporter Beth Tytel compared public transit schedules and some recent studies, and she found that the commute into and out of Boston has gotten longer in the past decade. And she joins us in studio to talk about this. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
Also with us is Chris Dempsey. He's the director of the group Transportation for Massachusetts. That's a group that works to provide transportation for Massachusetts residents and improve it. He's also a former state transportation official. Hi there, Chris.
Hey, Deborah.
Okay, so listeners, we want you to join in this conversation as well. Tell us about your commute. Is it getting worse? What do you do to pass the time? Have you had to make any changes because of the amount of time it takes you to get to work? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So Beth, I want to start with you. It seems like just about every year, maybe a couple times a year, there's a study about commuting, right?
Yes.
And it tells us who's got the longest, who's got it the worst. Oh, my gosh. So what's different about this particular analysis?
Well, what I wanted to do was to make it really tangible for people. I think it's one thing to say, oh, Boston commuters are stuck in 60 hours of traffic a year. But it's another thing to say, oh, the MBTA's number 505 express from Waltham to the Financial District that used to take 47 minutes 10 years ago now takes 63 minutes. That's a very real way to look at how much the traffic has grown, I think.
Right, right. It was fascinating. So tell us a little bit about what you found in these. It was, the bus from Fairhaven to Coppin?
Yeah, so what I did was I got the MBTA bus schedules. I compared them from 10 years ago to today, and also some private bus schedules. So, for example, there's a company called DATCO that runs a bus from Fairhaven, as you said, right to Copley. And that used to take, I think, about how many minutes? That took like
90, I think.
That took about 90 minutes, and now it's probably about 120 minutes. So you get 130 minutes.
So in 10 years, it went from 90 to 130 minutes to get from Fairhaven to Copley Square.
Exactly, and it's a similar story from Southern New Hampshire. In 2008, the 7:30 a.m. Boston Express bus from North Londonderry, New Hampshire, to South Station arrived at 8:35, and that was a 65-minute trip. Today, that same express bus gets in at 9:10, 100 minutes. So you can just see right there, in every case, the bus was leaving at the same time, making the same number of stops and following the same route.
And still.
Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. And just a lighter note, a real estate agent who sells in Waltham told me that they used to be able to advertise houses by saying a 20-minute trip into Boston, and they can no longer say that. He said it's too dangerous.
They stopped saying it. Well, yeah. Okay. And Chris, what do you think about this notion of traffic getting worse, and how do we know it and we're just not whining?
It's absolutely getting worse. There's a study by a company called INRIX that found that the average driver in Greater Boston wastes $1,800 per year in lost time and higher fuel costs. That was in 2016. In 2017, that jumped to $2,000 per year. So there are enormous economic costs to people of this congestion, but it's also quality of life costs. It's time away from your family. It's less time at the gym or eating healthy and more time stuck in really frustrating, soul-crushing traffic.
So let's talk about some of the reasons why. I mean, is it poor public transportation? Is it aging infrastructure? Certainly we all complain about the MBTA too. You know, is it more ride-sharing companies have cars on the road, a better economy, more people are employed, so there are more jobs here? I mean, Beth, what did you find, what seemed to be the main reason why people felt that their commutes were longer?
Well, that's interesting. You hit a lot of them. One thing is that there's just a much larger volume of cars on the road than there used to be. So that what that means is that if anything happens, rain, a few more cars getting added, things get much slower very quickly. A lot of the roads are what they call at capacity already, and I'm sure Chris can speak to this. So anything can mess it up. So you're getting the situation where you have these epic traffic jams now, like one, everybody leaves a little early because it's supposed to snow and they want to get their kids from daycare. So that really, right. Jams things up. So that's a problem. I think it's all those things added together, like the Uber drivers, the Lyft drivers, the construction, people, the economy's better, gas is cheaper. So, and people, a lot of people say to me they'd rather take the train and they might even live close to the train, but it doesn't run often enough or it doesn't leave at a convenient time. So, or it's too expensive. So it's so disappointing because you have all these people who do want to take public transportation, but it's not actually working for them.
Chris, what do you think some of the big factors are here?
Well, so Beth was really getting at this. You know, one of the issues here, the main issue, is that traffic is what engineering geeks call a non-linear function. And if you forgive the technical term there, what that really means is that at a certain point, every car that gets added to the system creates more congestion than the car that came before it. And it kind of looks like a hockey stick when you graph it. Sort of the road's open, the road's open, the road's open, and then all of a sudden, very quickly, it becomes congested. Now, that's a really bad dynamic. The only silver lining there is that if we can move ahead with some policies that take a relatively small number of cars off the road at rush hour, it can actually have a really big impact. You can move down that curve very quickly. The rule of thumb there is that getting 5% of the cars off the road at rush hour gives you a 20% reduction in traffic.
Huh.
It's kind of like when you drive in the summer on a Friday morning and the road feels really open.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that 20% of people are on vacation. It's that like 5% are, but the road feels empty. That's something that we should be trying to deliver to Massachusetts drivers every day.
Well, I wonder, though, because with technology, why do so many people have to drive during prime time and 9 to 5 when people can stagger now and it's so much easier? And if it would reduce traffic by 20%, that doesn't seem like an impossible thing to get 5% of the cars off the road. But there are so many callers, our lines are completely jammed. So we'll ask that question, or maybe one of our listeners will. Marjorie is calling from Norton. Marjorie, you're on the air.
Hi, this is such a great topic.
Okay, well, how come? Because you have a great commute, right, Marjorie?
Oh, no. I've been commuting for 40 years. Via subway, commuter rail, and by car, and I've never seen it as bad as it's been in the last 2 or 3 years. It's very frustrating, and I try to keep my sanity by listening to podcasts when I have to drive in.
Or the radio, of course.
Yes, of course. Trying to work from home one day a week, or taking the commuter rail, which is also a frustrating experience.
So mostly you're driving.
Most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you think it's gotten really bad in the past 2 years. So how long does it take you to go from Norton to Boston, typically?
Just this morning, it took me 2 hours. I was traveling about 35 miles, and I was doing 16 miles per hour.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Marjorie, thanks so much for the call. Jeff is calling from the Mass Pike. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. What can I tell you?
Well, tell me about your commute.
Oh, the commute is, well, I'm looking at it right now. And I'm traveling, Marjorie said she's at 16 miles an hour. I'm at 9.
You're at 9.
And,
where are you? On the Mass Pike where?
Yeah, in fact, I just flipped off the Mass Pike. I'm now on 128. And, so I don't know that I was a whole lot faster on the Mass Pike.
Mm. And it's a parking lot right now.
Well, it's moving at 9, market parking lot that moves at 9 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. So is that, so typically what's your commute like? Is it a couple of hours a day?
No, luckily I don't live that far away, but it was easily 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned to your producer, I more or less threw up my hands and worked 4 days a week from home.
Oh, you work 4 days a week from home now, so you don't have to do this every day. When did you start doing that?
Yeah. About a year and a half ago.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thanks so much. I want to talk with our guests a little bit about that. So Chris, what about that? Why, if folks like Jeff can work 4 days a week from home, Marjorie 1 day a week from home, why are we seeing traffic getting worse?
Well, look, it's just the demand issue. And I think you are, Deborah, you are seeing a lot of people shifting. They are working from home. A lot of people that are getting up at 5 in the morning so that they're on the road by 5:30 and trying to beat traffic. What they're seeing is that rush hour used to be, you know, maybe an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, and now rush hour is 3 or 4 hours long each of those times. So our roads are over capacity, and it's only when we do a smarter job of managing that limited road space that we're going to be able to get cars going at 65 miles per hour on a highway as they should be going. That's what they're designed for. That's what we can have them moving at, but we have to start to make some tough choices around how we use that limited road space.
Mm-hmm. Beth, I'm wondering what you think. Some of the reasons why we aren't seeing, you know, at least some kind of reduction from some things. Is it maybe ride-sharing companies also increasing volume on the roads?
Yeah. Well, there was that study that showed that a lot of people riding Uber and Lyft actually had MBTA passes. They were just deciding not to take them. But just picking up on something Chris said, I did some reporting earlier this year that showed that rush hour has expanded so greatly that it's basically always rush hour. Like, a lot of people told me, you think you're leaving early, but you're never leaving early enough.
Right.
And it's so you don't even know when you actually need to leave. Yeah, I think if you could, there's this, I think of it as the dreaded math of Boston traffic, which is that if you are, you leave 5 minutes later than you want to, it can cost you 20 minutes. Things really grow exponentially.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to just remind our listeners, we're talking with Beth Tytel, who writes for the Boston Globe, and her recent story was titled, "It's Not Your Imagination, Your Boston Commute Is Getting Worse." Chris Dempsey is with us as well. He's director of the group Transportation for Massachusetts, and we're talking about commutes. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We want to talk about solutions too, and we want to hear from you. What do you think would help make the drive into and out of Boston better? Paul is calling from Nahant. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Look, there's no question that this is getting to be a terrible headache for everyone, and there's no question that the ultimate solution is to finally raise the tax money to do rapid transit the way it should be done. But let's talk about some solutions that we can implement right now. First of all, let's expedite any construction project that impacts traffic. They did that very effectively with the Turnpike bridge rebuild over Comair. Mm-hmm. They finished it in 3 weeks. Whereas now the entryway to the Callahan Tunnel has been under construction for more than a year. They've turned it into an every morning nightmare. Mm-hmm. So instead of having 60 projects going on at once, let's do 20 projects and let's finish them in a few weeks rather than stretch them out month after month after month. Mm-hmm. Another thing, double parking. Double parking should be a capital offense, as far as I'm concerned. There is no reason why all of those high-paid policemen at the airport, the guys going down $200,000 a year, should be shooing people away from the front of the terminals when they should be in town shooing people away from double parking. All right, deliveries. Deliveries should be scheduled at night, not during the day. Let's get those big trucks off the road. And what about all those private construction projects where contractors think nothing about picking up a lane of traffic and having dump trucks and deliveries at any time of the day, and whether it's rush hour or not? Let's force them to stay within the bounds of the project, of the construction project itself, and stop letting them impinge on public roadways.
Okay. Paul, thanks so much. We've got a lot of suggestions there. Thank you for calling. Want to get some other callers in who can tell us about their commutes as well. Mike is calling about his commute from Boston to Gloucester. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
How long does it take?
Well, I started a job in Boston 12 years ago. It was 55 minutes door to door. Now the average day is an hour and a half, and it goes up from there depending on the on what goes on the road, like you were saying, rain or an accident.
So some days it's more than an hour and a half for you to get to Gloucester from Boston.
Oh, easily at least 1 or 2 days a week, mm-hmm. something happens that drives that up to an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours each way.
And why don't you take public transportation?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, although this is going to start sounding like more like group therapy for everybody calling in. I take the commuter rail occasionally when it's convenient. Like I had my car was in the shop and I had to take it, and it infuriated me because although I prepaid the ticket, no one was there to collect it on the train because that day the train, this is an evening rush hour commute home, around 5 o'clock train. There was only one conductor on the train, and he announced that the only thing he could do was let people on and off the train at the door. So nobody collected fares. Hmm. So if the T is running that inefficiently, you know, and they're calling for rate increases, I really find it hard to justify when they can't seem to make their current system work.
Hmm. So you basically think that the system is inefficient, and so you won't take You won't take public transit.
As I'm driving on Route 1 right now, I can see that, you know, the large majority of cars have one person in them. And I see that every day when I come in Boston or leaving Boston. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lack of confidence in the public transit system and the cost. Mm.
Right. Okay, Bridget is calling from Linfield. We're going to go to her next. Mike, thank you. Bridget, you're on the air.
Hi. I just moved from Topsfield to Linfield to cut 10 miles off my commute. It's helped a little bit, but what I wanted to share was my husband works for MIT, and they actually give him a T-pass, and they subsidize parking and the commuter rail. And so he has switched to public transportation because, he works for a great company, and they're able to do that. Public transportation from our house is actually more expensive than the gas and the tolls that it takes to get into Boston. So I think and it actually takes less time for me to drive than it does to take public transportation, because by the time I get to a T-stop, I've practically almost gotten to work, and then it's another 45 minutes to get to the stop that I need to get off at.
Right.
So I think time and money, even though traffic is horrible, it's better than the T.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bridget, thanks so much. Well, I'm going to talk with some of our guests about that. Beth, did you hear from a lot of folks those same things we're hearing? The commuter rail is not efficient. It's expensive. I'm looking at some of our callers that we may not be able to get to here, and they're saying it doesn't run at convenient times.
I heard all those things, especially from people with young kids at home or pets at home, someone who has to be able to rely on the fact they can get home. Of course, you might not get home on the road either, but they were afraid to take public transportation. I was really struck by the real-world impacts on the traffic people had on people's lives, including one working mother I spoke with, who said that if she's running late, not only does she have to pay $7 per half hour to get her infant son from his daycare, but she's still breastfeeding and her milk starts to build up, which adds extra urgency to her trip. And she said a lot of working mothers she knows pump while they're driving.
In traffic.
And I said, oh, that sounds tough. She said, yeah, but they like it because they're multitasking. Which seemed just like a lot for
working parents.
We're not
even supposed to text when we're drunk.
I know.
Let's not go there. But Chris, I'm wondering, why is it that it doesn't seem to be important, if you will, to improve our public transportation system so this isn't a continuing and increasing problem?
Well, it's hugely important, and we need more attention on that. And more investment in public transit will definitely help. I also like some of the other ideas that have been presented. You know, Paul from Nahant mentioned getting big trucks off of the road at rush hour. And that's really something that we need to be doing more of in Massachusetts. Other regions around the country are using smarter tolling policies to get big trucks off the road at certain times. So imagine giving a truck driver a discount for any time they shift their trip from 7:30 a.m. until 4:30 a.m. or even 10 a.m. Mm. That's a tool that is working very well around the country. And we don't do any of that in Massachusetts. We actually toll in kind of the dumbest way possible, which is a flat toll no matter what time of day it is and no matter what the demand for the road is. And that's really an antiquated way to be tolling. It doesn't give people a good experience on the road. We need to be thinking about how to make that better through smarter management of that road space.
So one of the big solutions, you would say, would be to change the way we toll for road use?
Absolutely. That is going to be critical to actually solving the issue of congestion on the roads.
Is it possible, or is it, I guess, efficient to try to do what Paul had suggested earlier in our conversation and expedite construction projects? He pointed out the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge and said that was done in 3 weeks, which does seem pretty miraculous.
That's part of it, too. And MassDOT is getting better every year at trying to bundle projects together and do whole corridors at once. But I think what Beth has really pointed out in her work is that this is not just a construction issue. This is really a day-to-day issue on our roads, even that are not undergoing any sort of construction. If we want to fix that problem, it's about better allocation of that road space. The construction piece will help around the edges, but it's not the game changer that something like a smarter tolling policy or better road management would be.
Advice to commuters. I'd like to hear from both of you. Beth, you go first.
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I would say take public transportation whenever you can, because to me it seems like even if it's a little bit longer, if you can afford the time, you can use it efficiently. You can work on your laptop if there's Wi-Fi. If not, you can work maybe offline, or you can read or listen to music. So you don't arrive feeling that you've wasted an hour hoping to make the green light.
Chris?
I think people are pretty sophisticated about their commute. I think people are mostly trying to find what works best for them. So I don't have any advice for any individuals other than to say that these problems are fixable. And they're going to be fixed through political solutions of getting more engagement with our elected officials and telling them that we're fed up with what we have today and we want new and innovative solutions. So my advice is to pick up your phone, pick up your smartphone, and email or call your legislator and say, we need change.
I just want to point out, too, we did get a comment from the Massachusetts Department of Transportation when we told them we were doing this on the show today, and it said, quote, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation is committed to promoting effective and reliable travel and helping people throughout the Commonwealth reach their destinations in a timely and efficient manner. While we may not be able to build our way out of congestion, MassDOT is providing more tools and resources than ever before so travelers can make smart decisions. So that's the state comment. I want to thank you both. Chris Dempsey is director of the group Transportation for Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Deborah.
Also, Beth Titel writes for the Boston Globe. A link to her recent article titled It's Not Your Imagination, Your Boston Commute Is Getting Worse is at our website, radioboston.org. Beth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, did you ever cheat or maybe fib on your taxes? Our next guest says it might be getting easier thanks to liberal state governments. We'll explain in a minute. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. 3 weeks from today is the deadline to file your taxes. So we want to take some time right now to talk about what appears to be an increasing problem, dodging or cheating on your taxes. Or, as former IRS Chief John Koskinen calls it, complying with your tax responsibility.
There are three types of taxpayers: those who comply, those who are trying to comply, and those who are actively trying not to comply. It's our responsibility to make sure everyone in those first two groups, those trying to comply, have everything they need to file their taxes as quickly and as easily as possible. It's also our responsibility to pursue those taxpayers who have decided not to comply.
Some estimates suggest that there are some taxpayers who underreport their taxable incomes, maybe not complying by an average of 64%. And our next guest says the new tax bill that passed Congress is probably only going to make things worse. Joining us to talk about tax dodging, who's doing it and why, is Evan Horowitz, Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Evan.
How you doing?
I'm okay. So how big of a problem is tax dodging in the U.S.?
Well, a lot of people try not to pay their taxes, some more than others. Mm-hmm. But even overall, I mean, about 8 in 10 people pay what they're supposed to pay, which means 2 in 10 don't. So it depends how you look at it. It's actually that rate's going down. So tax compliance has been going down over the past few decades. And the most recent numbers we have are from about 2007, 2008. So there's reason to think things have gotten worse.
Hmm. And why is that?
Well, a couple things going on. One, we are not funding the IRS adequately. In a self-defeating gesture, Congress has repeatedly cut the IRS budget. And when you cut the IRS budget, you actually lose money because that means less money for investigators, auditors. So you cut the IRS budget and people cheat more.
Right. So because they
can.
But people don't know. I mean, I don't know as a taxpayer that the IRS doesn't have enough money to audit. So
you're not cheating, which is good to hear. I'm glad to hear that. People who cheat are the people who can cheat. If you get a salary and a wage and a W-2, you know, you pick up a paycheck, odds are you're not cheating. Why? Because the IRS knows exactly what you're making and they take your money out in advance. So there's no opportunity to cheat. The people who are cheating tend to be those who report their own income to the IRS. That means independent contractors, small business people. That's where you get the 64% non-compliant or underreporting rate. If you're not reporting 60% of your income, that's because the IRS doesn't know anything about your income. You are supposed to tell them what you earn. So you drive for Uber or you run an independent consulting firm and people pay you in checks, you know, and so you're supposed to tell the IRS what you earn, but mostly people don't.
You also wrote about this recently, and you said that there may be some political reasoning going on here in terms of why people comply, underreport, whatever word we're going to use here.
Yes, yeah, so some fascinating recent research showing that partisanship is even worse than we thought. Basically, people cheat more when the president is from the opposite party. So if you're a Democrat and there's a Republican in the White House, you're going to hide more of your money from the IRS. And when it switches and Democrat takes the White House, Republicans will hide more of their money from the IRS. And we're talking, again, not about the people who get you know, W-2s and regular wages, but the people who run their own businesses, suddenly their income disappears. It becomes untraceable. And with IRS having less funding than it used to, they can't track as many of those people. So that's getting worse.
Hmm. You also say that the tax bill that passed Congress could make things worse because liberal state governments may do things also, right?
There are a couple of ways to think about
this. It's complicated.
Yeah. So there are... liberal state governments were really unhappy with a particular provision in the tax bill, which was, hey, guess what? You can no longer deduct all of your state and local taxes from your federal tax bill. This has been a boon for primarily blue states with high property taxes. It's gone. And some angry leaders of blue states said, well, let's fight back by finding new ways for taxpayers to avoid paying taxes. Let's pretend that these local tax payments are actually charitable donations or something. So, I mean, the problem there is it kind of reinforces the sense that taxpayers shouldn't pay what they owe. They should keep as much as they can and bend the rules to make that possible.
Ouch. And so 3 weeks from today.
It's coming. If you haven't paid your taxes recently, if you only have a vague recollection of having done it some like last year, that probably wasn't this year's taxes.
Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for being
with
us. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.